Hello, and welcome to the History of Gay Sex podcast. I'm glad you're with us. For our first episode, and in the spirit of irony, we're actually not going to be talking about self-identifying gay people. But we will be going back more than 2,500 years to an institutionalized form of homosexuality, and one that historians are beginning to think was much more widespread across humanity than we had ever suspected before. We will be going back to a time when civilizations were heavily based on all-male warrior cultures, and as a result, they became incredibly homosocial societies. Consequently, these societies created rituals and institutions that had a fundamental relationship to same-sex sex. On today's episode, we will be journeying back to the land of ancient Greece, and we will discuss a form of cultural homosexuality that seems absolutely unimaginable in comparison to society today. As an American, we have an interesting and consequential relationship from ancient Greece. In a way, America considers itself a progression of it. And when you hear this, you might be asking yourself, how or why? When we examine the historical events during the founding of America, the founding fathers only had a few examples of large-scale democratic societies to draw from: ancient Greece, Rome, and to an extent, Carthage. Specifically, in ancient Greece, the Confederation of Lycia, or the Lycian League, was considered a model for the U.S. and was the source of three major contributions. It was historically a federation of 23 city-states, where each sent a representative to the Lycian Assembly. The American House of Representatives, where states have representation in proportion to their population, was founded, as James Madison urged, on the principle of the Lycian Confederation. Moreover, it was mentioned multiple times in the Federalist Papers by both Alexander Hamilton and James Madison. The second contribution of Lycia to the American Constitution is representative government. Hamilton's criticism of the ancient republics was partly based on their aptitude to be ruled by faction when the people ruled directly, a claim that was echoed by Madison in the Federalist Papers. The third contribution of Lycia to American government was a strong federal government. In the Federalist Papers, Hamilton explains that in Lycia, the Common Council had the power to appoint all judges and magistrates for the confederated cities, and that federal laws applied directly to individuals, not just to cities. Under the then Articles of Confederation, there was no effective federal executive or judiciary, and this was impairing our newborn country's ability to function. But there are other examples of references to ancient Greece in America, including Thomas Paine in 1792, who wrote, quote, "What Athens was in miniature, America will be in magnitude," end quote. And Thomas Jefferson also drew inspirations from the Greek philosopher Epicurean when drafting the Declaration of Independence. These are also some of the reasons why the famous buildings and monuments in Washington, D.C. emulate ancient Greek and Roman architecture, also known as neoclassicism. Additionally, this architectural style can be found in almost every major American city, and specific examples of Greek revival include the Supreme Court building and Lincoln Memorial in Washington, D.C., and the Philadelphia Museum of Art, to name a few. There is also a whole litany of things whose origins come from, or if alleged to come from, ancient Greece. Doctors today take the Hippocratic Oath, the Olympics, Western philosophy, marathons, alarm clocks, umbrellas, cartography, Western theater, a portion of our alphabet, democracy, trials by jury, showers, cranes, arched bridges, and spiraled staircases. However, there's clearly a lot we do not share with ancient Greece, despite it being considered the origins of Western civilization. And before we get into Greek homosexuality, I want to give you an understanding of the society 2,500 years ago. Back then, ancient Greece consisted of several city-states, which were self-autonomous regions. The larger ones were Athens, Corinth, Sparta, Thebes, etc., and these comprised the area we know as the country of Greece today. The most famous example of democracy comes from Athens, but Athenian democracy is very different from the democracies we have today. Back then, a third of the Greek population were enslaved, and overall 90% of the population was excluded from the democratic process. Only men who were children of freeborn parents from Athens were included. And the fact that only 10% of residents had the privilege of partaking in the democratic process is probably why the Greeks invented the word idiotes, or idiot, for those who didn't. And the true defender of democracy were the warriors within it. And it is the culture that surrounded this that went on to create a rather elaborate form of ritualized homosexuality. In 1978, a scholar of ancient Greece named K.J. Dover published Greek Homosexuality, which thoroughly details homosexuality in Greece, but also the practice of pederasty, or boy love. And this was a huge deal. It was the first time in Western scholarship that someone ever fully addressed pederasty or homosexuality that took place in ancient times, and for that matter, since they couldn't before because of decency laws. But with the sexual revolution transforming society, scholars like Dover were beginning to come around to discussing ancient Greece in a more honest and open way. Before we start a deep discussion into the societal dynamics of the Greeks, I did want to clarify some important elements in this matter. Sexuality during the times of ancient Greece was very different than they are today. There were no concepts of homosexuality, bisexuality, heterosexuality. Sexual expression and activities were defined by the role that you took, and it would go on to be considered either male or female. Passivity and receptivity were considered feminine and womanly, while penetrative and dominant were considered masculine or manly. There was no notion at all of sexual identity during this time. Moreover, the first cultural references begin in the 8th century BCE of homosexuality in ancient Greece. By the time of the 6th century BCE, we know it's widespread across the entire region. The most famous expression of homosexuality in ancient Greece was known as pederasty. This was the relationship that early Greeks considered as almost a sort of rite of passage for Greek adolescents into adulthood. Although the scope of pederasty in society is debated, especially in Athenian society, where we are provided the most documentation on the social institution. Pederasty translates two words. The first word is pais, meaning boy, or paides, being the plural for boys. However, this word does also translate to daughter, son, slave, girl, and child. And erasti, or erastes, meaning lover, or lover of, coming from the word eron, which means love, and is connected to the Greek word eros, meaning to fall in love with and to have, quote, desires that can be satisfied, end quote. Eros is also the name for the Greek god that is the responsible natural force that makes us fall in love. He is a young winged male that in the Roman realm was known as Cupid. The word eros is the root word for the English words erotic and erogenous. The younger passive sexual partner was known as the eromenos, which translates to the beloved, or to be in love with, and to have a passionate desire for. The exact age of the eromenos is unclear, but the ancient Greeks believed that puberty was a sign of eligibility in the boys. Scholars suggest that given how Greeks talked about signs of puberty, one of the most important ones being height, that general estimates of the ages of the boys were between 13 and 15 years old. The eromenos is no longer a pais once he reaches full height and can grow a full beard. A lot of historians believe this to be around the age of 18. Eromenos were typically in the upper classes of Athens, which is the source of most of our information on pederasty. However, in Sparta, pederasty may have been compulsory to all free males given the extreme structures of society that were focused on the military. The older and active sexual partner was the erastes, or lover, and he was an adult male who was in the upper class of society in Athens as well. He would have been active in the military, which was an important element to the role of pederasty in ancient Greek society. The erastes would court the eromenos in various ways. Oftentimes, they would try to introduce themselves at the gymnasium, which word originally translates to the place of naked exercise. Naked exercise was incredibly common in ancient Greece, and it was an exemplification of how the Greeks celebrated their view of the beauty of the male body. There were even times that the erastes would get into physical altercations with each other over trying to catch the attention of the young eromenos. The erastes would sometimes sleep in the doorways of the homes of the eromenos they would pursue. Additionally, by showing examples of supplication, or the action of asking or begging for something earnestly or humbly, and entreaty, which is an earnest or humble request, and by swearing oaths to the commitment to the eromenos, which was considered very attractive and sincere within the community. It is noted that erastes would also bring gifts such as cockerels, hares, and other animals, and also included other gifts such as balls, flutes, and lyres. The Greek described this process as the hunt, or being out with the hounds. Greek fathers even had to warn their young sons not to talk to any older men when they were outside the home to prevent an Erastes from pursuing their son who might only be interested for solely sexual reasons. Fathers would even have their sons monitored by slaves, also known as pedagogies. Other factors in choosing an Erastes for a son included if the interested Erastes was of higher wealth and stature in the community. There are times that the entire family of the Eromenos could be elevated from such partnership, but for the most part, fathers would also make sure their sons did not choose an Erastes too quickly, as to ascertain the motives of the Erastes, just as we consider a woman who skeptically views the intentions of a suitor. After all, the ideal relationship of pederasty was seen as a celebration of two men who would love each other for the rest of their lives, despite their sexual relations being required to end by the time of the boy's maturity into adulthood, when he is no longer a pace. This common concern by fathers was expressed by Pausanias in Plato's Symposium with, quote, "The Erastes, who is in love with the body rather than the soul, loses interest when his Eromenos matures, and he breaks his promise of lasting love and gratitude. But the Erastes, who is in love with the good character of the Eromenos, stays for life, since character, unlike youthful beauty, is everlasting." Greeks would also consider the phenomenon of Eros between two men as, quote, "inspiring as much unselfish devotion," unquote, as what is seen between two members of the opposite sex. In Greek stories, examples of heroism and honor include examples of Eromenos and Erastes dying when defending the life of the other, or of the other one avenging the death or the murder of the other partner. With the pederastic society, Pausanias also goes on to state that, quote, "lovers would never act shamefully in battle because the eyes of their younger male companion would be upon them," end quote, showing that the effect that pederastic societies have adds to a level of army cohesion that strengthens the bonds of troops when going into battle. One of the most famous examples of pederastic love and courage is of the Eromenos Harmodius and the Erastes Aristogiton. The story goes, following the death of the tyrant Pisistratus in 527 BCE, his two sons, Hipparchus and Hippias, then took control of the affairs of Athens. Among the many abuses of these tyrants, Hipparchus attempted to seduce Harmodius. After rejecting the tyrant, Harmodius told his Erastes, Aristogiton, about the failed attempt at seduction. Hipparchus would go on to retaliate for this rejection and a cruel and public shaming of Harmodius' family. This humiliation was so great that Harmodius planned to assassinate the two tyrants of Athens as revenge. On the day of the assassination, the two lovers managed to kill only one of the tyrants, Hipparchus, before they themselves were killed after capture. Although Harmodius and Aristogiton's attempt at assassination was only partially successful, their bold action led the Athenians to revolt and overthrow the remaining tyrant Hippias. Consequently, the reputation of the lovers was cemented as some of the most heroic and notable defenders of democracy, and as the saviors of Athens. To the ancient Greeks, these two men were considered the ideal pederastic couple. Another example of an ideal pederastic couple was between Zeus and Ganymede. Zeus was so taken by the beauty of the mortal Ganymede that he made the boy immortal. Quote, "Boy love is such a delight, since even the son of Cronus, king of the gods, once came to love Ganymede, and seizing him, brought him up to Olympus and made him eternal in his lovely flower of boyhood," the author Theognis writes. The pederastic relationship of Zeus and Ganymede was ideal because of their age difference. But more importantly, it was a sign to the Greeks that it was okay for them to participate in the same kind of relationship. After all, whatever was acceptable for the gods, and especially for the king of the gods, Zeus, was also acceptable for mortals. This also meant that anything outside of the model of pairing between Zeus and Ganymede was less than ideal. The role of the Erastes was to teach his Eromenos the ways of the ancient Grecian world, how to act with courage and heroism, to discuss politics and philosophy, and to learn how to be a warrior of the polis, or city-state, and to teach to hunt and cultivate noble character in the Eromenos. The Erastes would also play a role in the Greek Symposium, which consisted of an aristocratic male event where Athenian men would lounge and drink wine while discussing poetry, philosophy, and politics. Here, Socrates would discuss the importance of instilling such philosophical ideas, not by the orator communicating to silent disciples, but of a cooperative process of question and answer, and mutual criticism concerning the topics at hand. This is known today as the Socratic method, which is still used in higher education. The symposium was a place to encourage higher learning and erudite thinking in Athenian society. but it was also just as much a social and sexual event as depicted by ancient Greek vase paintings. As mentioned earlier, the Erastes was the older active sexual partner, while the Eromenos would be the younger passive partner. When defining the roles and behaviors of passive and active, it is widely debated the extent of the sexual relationship and has been heavily argued over the years. The most commonly held view by scholars is that the combination of eros, or love, and the Eromenos' gratitude for having a devoted Erastes would result in the granting of favors, or charis, to the Erastes. The favors most likely included intercrural sex, fondling the Eromenos' genitalia, and masturbation. Intercrural sex, called diamerizine in Greek, translates to, quote, to do between the thighs, end quote. This typically involved the Erastes inserting his usually lubricated penis in between the closed thighs of the Eromenos. The Erastes would continue thrusting until ejaculation. This was the closest an Eromenos was supposed to get to any sort of sexual receptivity. This is significant because the Eromenos was not only a citizen of Athens, but also a man. It would be shameful and, quote, unmanly for a male citizen to be the receptive partner in anal or oral sex. Same-sex sexual experiences, such as those involving anal or oral, were only socially permissible by sex workers, non-citizens, and slaves. Sex workers could be free men who were not citizens and had lower expectations of them. They were not politically involved in Athenian democracy as citizens were. And if it were known that a male citizen of Athens was ever the receptive partner in anal sex or oral sex, they would lose their citizenry and rights to the city-state. Slaves incorporated several roles throughout the Greek society and had no say in how their bodies were used. Prostitution, or sex work, was legal for both men and women and was taxed at local levels. Slaves were used at their master's sexual disposal and had no choice over their bodies. Pederastic sex is heavily depicted in vase paintings and in rather explicit ways. It is common for the Eromenos and Erastes to both be in upright positions, signifying their dual male roles in the sexual act. The Eromenos is never erect because despite electing their involvement in pederasty, it was not socially acceptable for them to truly enjoy the sexual experiences. The Greeks considered the Eromenos as passive and non-reluctant. However, scholars are now debating that it was common and socially acceptable for the Eromenos to have been aroused from the actions of the Erastes. Although the Greeks in their own writing disagree on the social permissibility of certain actions, one Greek writer states, quote, any Eromenos who allows his Erastes to do whatever he wants to him has submitted himself to prostitution, end quote, which could lead to devastating penalties as mentioned earlier, but only for the Eromenos. Another Greek writer, when discussing unclearly defined notions of pederastic copulation, states, quote, the Eromenos is so overcome with gratitude for the benevolence of the Erastes that he embraces and kisses him, wants to lie down with him, and is disposed to refuse him nothing. And if their philosophical zeal is deficient, they may, in an unguarded moment, yield to temptation. This lapse will not destroy their eros or render it valueless, for the good is not undone. End quote. Moreover, oral sex was not allowed because of the bodily impurities given to what was considered the very important organ of speech. Likewise, an Eromenos was not supposed to be the receptive sexual partner in any way, which also included oral fellation. As mentioned, any Athens-free man who was copying a receptive sexual partner, or as they described as, quote, relegating yourself to the status of a woman, end quote, and this sort of gendered expression was dishonorable and unworthy of the ethos of a fighting man. Once the boy became an adult, the relationship was supposed to end sexually. Additionally, the pederastic system only allowed for homosexuality to exist between an adult male and an adolescent male. Any sort of sexual relationship between two adult men was not socially acceptable, even if it was without oral or anal intercourse. The origins of pederasty are largely unknown on a specific level, but we do know that it became prevalent in the 6th century BCE, although the sources of this practice are not entirely clear. The most widely accepted generalization about Greek homosexuality at the present time is that it originated in the military organization of Dorian states. The Dorians included Sparta, Argos, Corinth, and the cities of Crete. The biggest origin myth to pederasty lies in the island of Crete. It involves the story of ritualized homosexual rape. The Erastes gave notice of his intention, and the family and friends of the Eromenos did not attempt to hide the boy, for that would have been an admission that he was not worthy of the honor. If they believed that the Erastes was unworthy, they prevented their rape by force. Otherwise, they put up a good-humored and half-hearted resistance, which ended with the Erastes carrying off the Eromenos to hide out for 2 months. At the end of that, the two of them returned to the city. At this point in the relationship, the Eromenos was known as the Parastathes, or posted beside, and the Erastes was known as his philator. The Erastes would give the Eromenos expensive gifts, including clothing, which would thereafter testify to the achievement of the Eromenos in being chosen. There is no evidence of any of this taking place, and it departs from Athenian pederasty pretty largely. We also don't know generally if the use of these words were actually a part of Cretan society or if something that was appropriated by the Athenians. There were also Cretan laws that prohibited rape at that time, and we don't see any examples of exceptions for this pederastic practice. Another source of possible origins of pederasty come from nude athleticism in ancient Greece. We know that around 6th century BCE, when pederasty was prevalent across ancient Greece, that so too was nude athleticism. There are debates over the origins of the practice, but one of the myths included a runner named Orsippus of Megara, and when Orsippus lost his loincloth in the midst of a sprint, he was said to run even faster, gaining him victory and fame. Running naked would become a competitive advantage in the eyes of the Greeks. Although, there is another story involving Orsippus, but instead of winning from his nude advantage, he actually loses the race from tripping over his loincloth. Nude athleticism would go on to become something that was very characteristically Greek. In fact, the Greeks felt so strongly about the practice that to feel ashamed by one's own public nudity in such a space was a sign of being a barbarian. Although we may never truly know the origins of nude athleticism, we do know that the role of the gymnasia took place in ancient Greece. As mentioned, it was a place that extended into education, which was another possibility of where the mentor role of the Erastes originated. Additionally, in one poem by the Megaran poet Theognis, who saw athletic nudity as a prelude to pederasty, writes, quote, "Happy is the lover who works out naked, and then goes home to sleep all day with a beautiful boy," end quote. Another large source for Greek homosexuality comes from the plays of ancient Athens. These sources are important because they provide a context of the practice outside of the social sources where it took place. However, the extent to the content and value of discussions and references in Greek plays is heavily debated amongst classical scholars, and the presentation of homosexuality takes on a lot of forms. Eubulus, comic poet of the 4th century BCE, made jocular suggestions about the 10 years' battle for Troy and the impact it had on the troops. He claimed in a comic tone that without women for the warriors to have sex with, that masturbation alone was not enough to satisfy the troops, so they all ended up engaging in anal sex with one another. He makes a joke about the anatomical implications on the men that is not worth repeating here. Moreover, his comic reference to the consequences of men being left together for extended periods of time is one that is almost universally exhibited across many cultures throughout time. However, the explicit detail he discusses here is rather surprising given our assumptions on historic notions of decency in human history. Through comedy, written in ancient Athens, we are presented with themes and examples of homosexuality that were created specifically for the masses in society. This helps us elucidate a different perspective of homosexuality and pederasty, while also giving us an idea of its scope within society. Aristophanes, who was a famous playwright and whose plays made wide appeals to his commoner audiences, provides an interesting example of homosexuality and pederasty for us to examine today. Specifically, he considered pederasty as a form of elite self-indulgence and associated it with corruption. In his plays Wasps, Aristophanes uses the chorus to give a brief resume of his own dramatic career. He writes to his commoner audience, quote, "Being raised up to great height and honored like no one among you before, he did not turn out haughty nor puff up his pride, nor raise a ruckus and make passes at the boys in the gym. Not even if any lover asked him to make fun of the hated boy love, did he comply, as he says, but he kept fitting thoughts in mind, lest he make bawds of the muses whom he employs." End quote. Here he clearly distinguishes himself as a successful playwright who never indulged in the pederasty of high society. But Aristophanes does not stop here. He uses references to pederasty and homosexuality as the weapon to deliver his social blows. In Acharnians, Aristophanes describes the politician Cleon, whom he dislikes as, quote, that man, a wretch, and a bugger in matters of state, end quote. Although there are some disagreements over the other interpretations of Aristophanes' works, in the examples he uses homosexuality to criticize the elites, it is debatable if they are criticizing the practice or the fact that it was exclusively used by the elites in Greek society. Every instance that Aristophanes criticizes homosexuality is always a variable in addition to something whether it pertains to someone who appears to exhibit sexual mania, such as Alcibiades, or a politically unruly leader. Another example of the use of homosexuality, or pederasty, as a weapon for insulting the upper classes is seen as an example of the upper class living a life of leisure while the masses have to, quote, take it, end quote, suggesting the emasculating aspects of elite rule over the commoners. The same is more or less said of politicians. The poet Plato Comicus disdainfully and sarcastically writes, quote, they, being the Eromenos, grow up to turn into the real men of politics, end quote. Moreover, there are large distinctions that have to be made regarding the accusations of a bugger or slang Greek terms for passive sexual partners with a method of criticism towards foreigners or people of unsavory qualities and character. Just as high schoolers might use the term gay to mean something as dumb or without value, while also meaning something is effeminate or weak. We also have to see the contextual examples this is used in for comparison. Greeks would often accuse their neighboring city-states, who were also their enemies, as buggers or catamites, which was Greek for sodomites. This was more of a method of othering a person or a community rather than making true remarks involving homosexuality and other social functions within those societies. This also plays into the view of sexual receptivity by men and its social unacceptance from its feminine qualities. There's also no better insult to the comparison of your neighboring warriors as, quote, women, which exudes notions of stupidity and physical weakness in their eyes. At this point, you're probably wondering, well, after all things said and done, why did this exist? And so there were a couple of things that, after doing a lot of research, I kind of came up with on my own. One of them is the military and the fact that there are beliefs that it strengthened troop cohesion with the courage that is shown within Eros, which would obviously be important in a military society. You also have to take into consideration that this was a hyper-masculine society. Men were the only celebrated intellectuals, and they were stereotyped as superior with inherent qualities over women. If a man was looking to have any kind of intellectual relationship at the time, it would have been impossible to have that with a woman, especially including someone's wife. Women weren't educated at the time. They were cloistered in their houses. They didn't really have a role in society. And they were kind of just seen as something that's used to grow a Greek family. Also, we have to look at the fact that Greeks celebrated male beauty in a very different way than we can think of today. They openly talked about the beauty of a young male concerning their physique, their muscle development, and it's really something that men don't talk about today, but it's something that was an open aesthetic value back in the day. I wanted to quote from Dover, who actually has a very elaborate response about why this took place within society. And he goes on to say, quote, we can assume that homosexual relationships satisfied a need that was not found elsewhere in ancient Greek society. What factors allowed or encouraged the satisfaction of that need to take place in such an elaborate way as it did? It seems to me that the need was for a personal relationship of an intensity not typically found within marriage or in the relations between parents and children or those between the individual and the community as a whole. The deficiencies of familial and communal relationships can be derived ultimately from the political fragmentation of the Greek world. The Greek city-state was constantly confronted with the concerns of its own survival and the ever-present aggression by neighboring city-states. And for this reason, the fighter, who was the only adult male citizen, was the person who mattered. Likewise, only the adult male possessed the power to deliberate and make political decisions, and hold authority to approve or disapprove of social and cultural innovation within the community. Consequently, the inadequacy of women as fighters promoted a general devaluation of the intellectual capacity and emotional stability of women, and the young male was judged by such indication as he afforded of his worth as a potential fighter. Males tended to group themselves together from military, political, religious, and social purposes, to a degree which fell short of welding them into a totally efficient fighting machine, but was nevertheless enough to inhibit the full development of intimacy between a husband and wife, or between a father and son. Erastes and Eromenos clearly found in each other something which they did not find elsewhere, When Plato said that the Eromenos realizes that the love offered by his Erastes is greater than all of his family and friends put together, he was speaking of an idealized philosophical Eros, and yet he may have been a little closer than he realized to describing the everyday Eros. Plato's philosophical view of pederasty is essentially an exaltation of a consistent Greek tendency to regard homosexual Eros as the compound of an educational relationship with a genital relationship. The strength, speed, endurance, and masculinity of the Eromenos were treated as the attributes which made him attractive, that of a potential and future fighter. The Spartans and Cretans further professed to have much more regard for qualities of character than bodily beauty. The Erastes was expected to win the love of the Eromenos by his value as an exemplar and by the patience, devotion, and skill which he displayed in training the Eromenos. In fact, the educational responsibility of the Erastes was so that he bore the blame for deficiency in courage manifested by his Eromenos. Education is the key word in the evaluation of this homosexual relationship, and the importance that the Erastes was able to transfer qualities from himself to his Eromenos. Most relationships of any kind are complex, and the need for bodily contact and orgasm was one ingredient of the complex needs that was met with the homosexual Eros. Over the course of the following centuries, the practice of pederasty becomes slowly less common throughout Greece. And by the time the Roman Empire turned to Catholicism in the 3rd century CE, it was completely banished. If you like this episode, please subscribe and leave a review. And please reach out to me at gaysexhistory@gmail.com with any questions or thoughts on the show. I'm looking forward to hearing all feedback from listeners.